Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor, and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. My normal partner, Elliot Cohen, a Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is traveling. But we have today as our very special guest, Will Selber, Military Affairs Fellow at the Bulwark Online, as well as a veteran of 20 years as a Middle East Foreign Area Officer. Publishing on his own Substack, and soon, I guess, to the podcast Shoulder to Shoulder.
Yes, Shoulder to Shoulder, Untold Stories from a Forgotten War. Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, well, great. I'm looking forward to hearing that. And your Substack is Grumpy Old Veteran?
Grumpy Combat Veteran,
yeah. Grumpy Combat Veteran. Okay, great. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to...
Oh, no, you're fine.
I must have been thinking of myself.
So. No, sir. It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
Will, it's great to have you, and it's timely because had not only tours downrange in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you were there for the denouement in Afghanistan. You've written about that for the Bulwark. I want to start with part of the aftermath of that, which is the recent ISIS-K, the ISIS Khorasan Province group, disastrous attack, terrorist attack in Moscow, which even President Putin has conceded is Islamist, although he's trying to wrap it in a Ukrainian envelope somehow. But what does that say, do you think, about the terrorist potential that we've left behind in Afghanistan? I mean, I know that General Kurilla, the CENTCOM commander, a year ago testified to the Congress that he thought ISIS-K was maybe 6 months away from having the capability to attack the homeland. He's reiterated that there's concern about attack on the homeland from ISIS-K in his more recent posture statement and hearing. What is your, as a professional who's looked at this and fought in these wars, what is your take on that?
Yes, it's a great question. I remember in 2014, I was in Afghanistan on my third tour when ISIS-K started coming up. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't think that they were going to have a lasting stand in Afghanistan, which shows you that there's been a lot of misanalysis on this. But I think that one of the important things to look at Islamic State in Khorasan Province is not only did they do an attack on Moscow, they did the same day an attack on Kandahar as well. And that is important to note because it was an attack on the spiritual homeland of the Taliban movement. And so they did that. And then months earlier, they also conducted a strike on Iran on the ceremony for Qasem Soleimani's death as well. So those are some recent attacks that they've done. And I think it goes to the heart of the matter that what we left behind in Afghanistan is a state that is controlled by a terrorist organization, the Taliban, that does not have the ability to do counterterrorism operations and to control that state, especially in the northeastern province. This is where the Islamic State kind of has a foothold. We struggled with that as well, but the Taliban do not have the ability. And then it's questionable if they have the desire to do so as well.
So let me ask you a couple of questions about that. One is the ODNI's statement about worldwide threat basically said the Al-Qaeda threat is pretty much over and done with, that they don't anticipate Al-Qaeda will be able to reconstitute itself in Afghanistan. But the fact of the matter is, A, it's not the only terrorist threat. Obviously, ISIS-K is the more serious threat right now. But we've left behind, essentially, a petri dish for terrorists. I mean, the Doha agreement said that the Taliban was not supposed to host terrorists, but obviously we know they're violating that agreement because when we ourselves killed Ayman Zawahiri, he was in Afghanistan in a guest house, if I recall correctly. And they can't control ISIS-K. So from that point of view, does it strike you that the DNI statement kind of was diminishing a little bit the terrorist threat that still resides out there?
I don't think that the DNI, I read it, is accurate on Al-Qaeda. I believe that Al-Qaeda is still in Afghanistan. They never went away. They're getting stronger. They are part of the government. Sirajuddin Haqqani is the Minister of Interior. His father, Jalaluddin Haqqani, was a close ally of Osama bin Laden. Sirajuddin Haqqani, the Minister of Interior, controls the police force, and it also controls who issues passports in Afghanistan, which should scare everybody to death. So Al-Qaeda is part of the government, not only just him, but also Khoury Boroyal, who is the governor of Kapisa province and also has also served in Kabul over the last 2 years, another mid-level commander. So I believe that Al-Qaeda is inside of the government. They've also, if you look at the United Nations recent sanctions and monitoring team report, they reported that there are multiple Al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan. So I would agree that the Islamic State has shown a recent capability to conduct attacks across the borders. But I still believe that Al-Qaeda has the intent and purpose to conduct attacks against the United States homeland. And they said so. And Al-Qaeda pledged fealty to Mullah Omar and to Hebatullah Akhundzada, who recently in a recent report said that he was God's representative on earth, which is the exact type of language that we heard from Mullah Omar 20 years ago. And so I think that both groups are a threat to the homeland.
Yeah. So we've got an ongoing threat. What's your judgment, Will, about, our ability to deal with that threat? The administration, when it made the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, and then after the pretty disastrous collapse of the government and the messy withdrawal in August of 2021, basically said we would constitute an over-the-horizon counterterrorism capability to keep tabs on all this. My question is, how confident are we that an over-the-horizon capability will really enable us to deal with this sort of Hydra-like multi-headed terrorist threat, one that's got a foot inside the government, as you say, with Al-Qaeda, and the other with, ISIS-K, which is in opposition to the Taliban government, but clearly capable of operating from there. The administration basically used the Zawahiri strike to say, oh, see, we've got our over-the-horizon capability. But I know from my own experience in government, I've been out for a long time now, since 2009, so almost a decade and a half. But certainly when I was inside, what I would hear from folks both in the military and the IC is, if you don't have folks on the ground, if you're not working human sources, just doing this with, various other ints rather than UMINT is not sufficient. What is your sense as a practitioner?
So I'm a career intelligence officer, mostly specializing in human intelligence. I've done foreign internal defense. I spent about 3.5 years in Afghanistan and a year in Iraq. My thought is that the over-the-horizon counterterrorism option is limited, and it cannot find all the people that you're looking for. The strike on Zawahiri was a success, and I know the people who were involved in it, and they did a great job, and God bless them for doing it. But at the end of the day, you're also relying on the Pakistani government to help you do counterterrorism operations in Afghanistan. And the Pakistani government, through the ISI, was the safe harbor for the Taliban. They are the reason, in my opinion, that the Taliban was successful in pushing us out of Afghanistan. And so if you're going to do over the horizon and just solely look at that, you're also going to more than likely use their bases to launch drone attacks from. And it's a deal with the devil yet again. I would absolutely echo your sentiments. You know, we inside the intelligence community, they are divesting of Pashto linguists, which are the main language spoken by the Taliban throughout the country and also the Haqqani network. So there's a divestment going on throughout the IC. And that's understandable to a degree because the existential threat is Russia and China. But now that we don't have any human sources on the ground, or at least nobody that we can operate outside of inside of Afghanistan, you're just relying on OSINT and more than likely SIGINT and some other ints to try to pinpoint. And we had a hard time doing that even when we were in Afghanistan. I mean, we missed Al-Qaeda training camps while we were in Afghanistan. In 2019, I think we've stumbled upon some. So it's going to be even harder for us to do that while we're thousands of miles away trying to pinpoint where some of these HVTs are.
So it's a worrisome, I think, you know, situation for those of us who have had some experience of dealing with these kinds of things in the past. It certainly worries me. I want to go back to the initial decision to withdraw and the way it was executed, because you were there, so you're an eyewitness to the execution. So let me start with the decision. In some sense, you know, the Biden administration likes to make the argument that their hands were tied because they had to deal with the Doha agreement that had been reached by the Trump administration that Secretary of State Pompeo signed, negotiated by my former colleague in government, Zal Khalilzad, our former ambassador to Afghanistan, and a native-born Afghan immigre to the United States, educated here. And there's some truth to that, of course. They did inherit that agreement. You know, there's nothing that says they had to, continue the agreement. They could have repudiated the agreement, and or they could have insisted that the Taliban abide by the agreement, because the Taliban wasn't abiding by the agreement once they came into office. The Taliban abided by those parts that they enjoyed the benefits of, like the release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners, but they never stopped. They stopped attacking the U.S., but they never stopped attacking, and they never really sat down to negotiate with the Afghan government as the agreement called for. That is one question. Was it kind of, smart? Was there an alternative to just, accepting the agreement as it was? Secondly, people make the argument, the administration does for sure, that had they decided to stay, the Taliban would have turned on the United States and resumed attacking the U.S. Now, U.S. casualties were quite low even before the Doha agreement. So, I'm not quite sure how to parse that. But in any event, the military advice that they received was to keep a residual force in Afghanistan and the contractor to continue to support the Afghan National Security Forces. And they chose not to do that. I believe General Miller, who was the final commander, was quoted as saying that with as few as 5,000 troops, he could keep going pretty much in indefinitely. So I guess the questions are, one, was it wise to, insist on continuing with the agreement? And B, do you think that the alternative of staying was a reasonable one that could have been executed?
So I think the Doha agreement was good in theory, but then it wasn't enforced. So I listened to all the testimony by General Milley, and I read it again, and there was a statement in there that finally came out into the open in the public sphere, where General Milley admitted that the Taliban had attacked American forces. And they did throughout the entire last year, they attacked American forces. Now, they did not did they not kill American forces? But that in and of itself was a break of the Doha Agreement, and it happened under Trump and the Biden administration. So I would talk to a lot of the Afghan negotiators when they were in Doha coming back, and the entire time was they are just playing us. They are just stringing this along. After the Doha Agreement, then they had like pre-talks before the talks happened. And just the framework alone to get into the Doha Agreements, to start really talking about it, took 4 or 5 months. And it was, and you could see even while they were doing that, they were starting to incrementally get closer and closer to the provincial capitals. So I don't think the Doha Agreements were wise because we did not back it up with a stick. And the Afghans could see us doing that. I spoke with all the senior officers as a inside the attaché office, and they could see us like not holding them accountable for breaking this, and that sapped morale throughout the entire ANDSF because they could see us doing this. So I don't. At the end of the day, I don't think it was wise. I think it was a good idea to try to think maybe we could do this. I wish it would have happened earlier in the campaign when we had higher amounts of forces, maybe during the Obama administration or stuff like that, where we had a little bit more momentum. But second, the question about staying. Look, I am a advocate that we should have stayed. Now, if you're going to say that, then you have to then come back and say, there's going to be American deaths because of it. I don't know how many it's going to be. Let's just say it's 15 to 20, maybe it's 100. I don't know. Will Selber's opinion, that's worth it because we are able to keep the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, all these groups that are now operating freely at bay. And while we also keep bases up against the border against China as well. I mean, there's other things that we're able to do by having bases in Afghanistan as well. So I think it was worth it. You could have had 4,000, 5,000 troops, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more. Then you also have the Europeans as well. NATO's there also. And the majority of the people who are doing the dying and fighting are the Afghans. And this is really what I really want to kind of, the tragedy of the Afghan war, and there's so many different aspects of it, but one of them at least, is that after 20 years, finally you started seeing the young generation of Afghan general officers making it up through the senior ranks. I know you had General Sadat on this, Sami Sadat on this.
We did, yes. Yeah, did. Very impressive.
Very impressive, a good friend of mine. Him, it's not just him, General Alizai, the last ANA chief, Mustafa Wardak, who was a corps commander who trained at the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, Kulshal Sadat. So you had all of these general officers, young general officers who studied in the West, starting to come up through the ranks. And they were starting to finally grab power from the old guard. And then it went away. And the big thing that really hurt them was the contract support.
Yeah, I really wanted to get into that, Will, because that's something I felt very strongly, you know, from the get-go, which was, okay, if you're going to pull out all the U.S. troops, okay, I mean, I don't agree, but I get that. But the removal of all the contract support and pulling out of Bagram and like throwing the keys over the fence, you know, to the Afghans, leaving without telling them, to me was absolute, you know, dereliction of duty. And here's why I say that. You know, I had a predecessor as Undersecretary of Defense, Bob Comer, who was known essentially, among other things, for having presided over the CORDS program in Vietnam as the deputy to General Creighton Abrams, and of having essentially been very successful at counterinsurgency. I mean, people tend not to realize this about the Vietnam War, but the insurgency part of it had actually been defeated by the time we lost. We didn't lose to the Viet Cong. We lost ultimately to the North Vietnamese Army that came across the border after we left. But, you know, Bob Comer wrote a study called Bureaucracy Does Its Thing for RAND after the fact, about the training of the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. And what he said was, we basically created a little mini U.S. Army in Vietnam, and then we left, and they weren't able to sustain it. And I worried about this while I was in government. I actually raised it in a speech I gave in 2006. I worried that we were doing exactly the same thing. And if you read the report of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan, SIGR report, after the departure and the retrospective, it's very clear that one of the things that led to the debacle was the fact that we trained the Afghan National Army and the security forces to essentially fight the way we fight, with the kind of mission, you know, control that we use, kind of the template that we use, and with contract support, I mean, with close air support provided by the U.S. Air Force and contract support for their rotary wing aircraft and for everything else that, you know, the trucks, the vehicles, everything that makes a military work. And we pulled that all out. And then we wondered why they couldn't, you know, why they couldn't and wouldn't fight for themselves. I mean, one of the things I found most offensive about President Biden's statements in the end days was about the Afghans not fighting, you know, for themselves, when we had literally made that impossible. Am I wrong, or is that?
No, sir, you're not. Yes, I think, you know, the thing that I, when I talk about Afghanistan, the biggest thing that I get is the Afghans didn't fight. And that's unfortunate for so many reasons, because they did. 70,000 of them died fighting just ANDSF, right? And then in the last year alone, 3,800 of them fought. So they fought. And it didn't just happen overnight. This was a thing that happened over years because of multiple things. And we can get into that as well. But what we did was that we built an army in our own image. We made it addicted to close air support, ubiquitous intelligence, and fires. Now, and then what we did was we trained them to do this, and they were pretty proficient at it. If you look at the ANISOC, which is the Special Operation Corps, and the Afghan Air Force, they were a very, very effective fighting force, very effective. I know a lot of these guys, and the Afghan Air Force was pretty good. I mean, you had A-29, C-130s, a rotary wing. The Special Mission Wing did nightly insertions of commandos all over the battlefield. But the contract support, they weren't there yet to do the logistics, to do the maintenance, to even do the administration part, because the contractors did that too. So when they pulled all those out, it ground to a halt. So much so that they were thinking about doing, like, trying to help some of the Afghan Air Force mechanics via Zoom. So you call in via Zoom and you kind of point to something and you try to figure it out. And that's no way to conduct a war, especially when the Afghan Air Force is flying all the time and they're breaking down. And I think that if you look at the fighting force, the top echelon, you had a lot of people that were willing to fight, and they were willing to fight. And even towards the end, they just ran out of ammunition. They ran out of bombs. They ran out of the ability to get their people off the battlefield. If one of the things, if I may, sir, to kind of underscore about the Afghans. Look, I fought with the Afghans. I fought with the Afghan local police. I helped train Afghan National Army, Afghan police. Some of them weren't good. It's a, you know, impoverished nation that's going to take a long time to get to that point. But I would also underscore that, like, for us, like, I served for 3.5 years in Afghanistan. I'm considered, like, somebody who's been around a long time. These guys and gals as well fought their entire lives. Like, I got to go to the base at night. They had to stay there and fight. Not only that, if you got injured, lost a leg, or got hurt, like, the amount of, like, the government taking care of you was very minimal. They just did not have that capacity. So I think that it's important for Americans to understand that they fought. They fought very well for a long time. It's just that the support, the maintenance, the support elements were not there at the end, and it just ground to a halt.
Yeah, you know, you make a point, Will, that I make all the time when I try and talk to people about Afghanistan, which is the degree to which it is one of the poorest societies on earth. And, you know, one factoid, and I don't remember now what percentage it is, but that the the you know the income average per capita in Afghanistan is lower than Haiti, and by a lot lower than Haiti. And so I think, you know, for Americans who are watching, you know, nightly now the scenes of what's going on in Haiti and having some sense of that, that Afghanistan was, you know, by an order of magnitude practically poorer, is, I think, important, you know, important to bear in mind. Yeah, my sense all along, when I would go to Afghanistan, meet with commanders, meet with troops, was that it wasn't a problem of getting, you know, Afghans to fight, but that we did have, you know, some challenges. I mean, not the least of which was literacy. I mean, that you know, there was so much illiteracy in the country that, I mean, you had to begin by actually teaching, you know, Afghans essentially how to read and write. And this was a product of before our time, before the Americans got there, the, you know, 20 years of war that preceded us, which was the Soviet, 10 years of Soviet occupation, and then the 10 years of Taliban rule and civil war that, you know, just kind of tore the country apart.
Yeah, I think that in Afghanistan, there was a lot of progress that had been made. It would just, I mean, people would talk about corruption, and it was absolutely a problem that we helped exacerbate by dumping full of aid money onto an impoverished nation and trying to make just quick impacts just in the next year, instead of looking at it for a very long time horizon. So we dumped a lot of money on it. And because the American government and the international community rotated out of that country at 6 to 1 year increments, we didn't know where it was going from. And so
we were reinventing the wheel every year.
Oh, it was even worse than that. I know that General McMaster is very fond of saying that, you know, it wasn't a 20-year war, it was a 1-year war fought 20 times. I would say it was even worse than that, because only a few people, few institutions deployed for a year. The majority of it was 4 to 6 months. And so it was, you know, hundreds of times people just rotating out. I had a boss in Afghanistan when I was advising the Ministry of Interior of Intelligence. Europol officer, very, very smart, but he would stay for 4 weeks, and then he would go on vacation for 2 weeks, and then he would come back for 4 weeks, and then he would go on vacation. And this is just a microcosm of the entire problem, is that we didn't have the institutional knowledge to do a lot of that stuff.
Will, I had a sense too, tell me if you think this is wrong, but I would go and talk to a lot of special forces units, and it was white soft, not black soft. But what they were doing was basically hunter-killer missions. And I kept thinking to myself, shouldn't you guys be doing the FID mission? Shouldn't you be doing foreign internal defense? Shouldn't you be training the Afghans? Why are you guys doing, you know, what JSOC is doing?
No, I think you're right. I think that, so I think there was a lot that were, some of them were. So the big FID mission for SOF in Afghanistan was the Afghan local police. Right, the village stability operations. I did that for a year in Northwest Kandahar. But even talking to some of the Green Berets there, you could tell that for a lot of them, this wasn't what they liked. They liked to do the like door kicking, right? Like Rangers, you know, JSOC, all the fun stuff, right? You know, they had a little bit had lost that muscle memory of doing like foreign internal defense. And so I think that a lot of that got kind of pushed off to other units to do. And some of them were good at it. Some of them weren't. I am fond of saying a lot of the American advisors needed advising. And you know, you come in there. It's like when I would first sit down with an Afghan general officer, the first question I would ask him was, how many advisors have you had? And often would be like as many as the stars in the sky. Right. And so, you know, and they all have their own agendas trying to push the ball real quick. And so you just lose that capacity, and it hurt us there for sure.
You know, another thing I think that we missed a big opportunity on, and I tried a little bit to help on this, although I obviously didn't succeed. But, you know, this was fundamentally an agricultural society. And I mean, I'm saying this because I'm, you know, looking at you on the screen and seeing your, you know, your Aggie hat on. And, but, you know, we have a lot of, you know, a lot of A&M universities in the United States, notably Texas A&M, but that's not the only one. They had a lot of, you know, resident expertise. And, you know, you were saying that we were pouring a lot of money into the, you know, assistance mission, which, you know, completely distorted the economy. But I'm not sure we ever really kind of got to the agricultural economy, which is the basis of the society, that, you know, might have done us more good in the long term. But again, part of that was because people were looking for short-term fixes rather than a long-term solution, and even talking long-term, because, you know, my sense of it when I first went out there was this is going to be at least a 20-year or 30-year, you know, project, if not longer.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I think one of the problems with the Afghan war is that we didn't really speak honestly about it. It was always like, we've turned the corner, we've defeated, we're winning. And, you know, instead of being like, this is going to take a very, very long time, this is going to be 40 years, they're making progress, but, and, you know, they're not what we wish they were, but they're the best that they can be. And always saying, compared to who? Compared to Pakistan, Iran, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, which one's next door? I mean, compared to them, not that bad. But yeah, for the agriculture, I was on, you know, a provincial reconstruction team in Kapisa province. We had some, we worked with some agricultural development teams, which were National Guardsmen who were, most of them were farmers and stuff like that. And they did some good, but the problem, like you alluded to, is that there was no real long-term thought process on how to make this a little bit better. Instead, it was just pour something in, let's get some quick results. And by doing that, you don't really think long-term, you just pour money into it. So one of my favorite examples is there was a great hospital that the South Koreans built years in the early years of the conflict, but there was no staffing for it. So the Taliban took it over and used it. It was one of their field hospitals. So these are the type of things that we kind of ran into throughout the 20 years.
Let's talk a bit about the, we've talked about the decision to leave. Let's talk about the way, you know, the way we actually left. You know, I don't want to, you know, claim any special prescience, but, you know, I did write in the Bulwark and the Dispatch about my concerns about the decision. In April of 2021, I thought it was the wrong decision. Like you, I thought we could and should stay there. I thought the cost was worth bearing because of the potential to keep terrorists at bay. I mean, I frankly had another reason, which is that, you know, if you worry about terrorists getting their hands on nuclear weapons, which right now we're more worried about Russians having their hands on nuclear weapons, but if you are worried about that, the most likely route to that happening is in Pakistan. And, you know, having a force in Afghanistan is, you know, frankly, would have been useful to have in place in case something goes terribly wrong in Pakistan and those weapons start getting loose, or we start worrying that they're going to get loose. And so, you know, that was a major concern for me. But starting in July, I started to get worried that things were coming a bit unglued. I actually did Bill Kristol's podcast, his conversations with Kristol in July, and worried about it. And then about a week before it all fell apart, I had a piece in the Bulwark, which was saying this is, you know, looks like it could come down really fast. And of course it did. I'd be very interested in your view, since you were on the ground there and saw it, about the sort of finger pointing that went on. You talked about General Milley and General McKenzie's their testimony. You know, I don't know that anybody pushed General McKenzie, but it was widely reported at the time he was in Doha, and it was widely reported that Mullah Baradar offered him that the U.S. could secure Kabul before the Taliban came in, and he did not report that back to Washington. in part because he thought he knew what the answer would be, that it would be no, because it would require additional troops to go in to secure the city. Although it seems to me that that would have been much preferable to, you know, what we certainly ended up with. I don't know how much Frank regrets that, but I mean, to me, that's one major regret that we didn't do that. But there seemed to be a lot of finger pointing that the State Department, particularly Chargé Ross Wilson, who Foreign Service colleague of mine, we served together in Moscow, didn't pull the plug quickly enough on ordering the evacuation. Ambassador Wilson has his own view of it. John Bass, former ambassador, who's also a former Foreign Service colleague of mine, they're both good people, was the Undersecretary for Management. He got deputized to go out there and oversee the evacuation. What do you, as someone who was, you know, there on the ground, what do you make of the kind of finger pointing and the, you know, who hit John here?
So I was there from basically the last year. I left about 6 weeks before the fall. But I will tell you that watching this and watching the finger pointing, what I want people to understand is that we're all to blame for what happened, right? We are all to blame. The Department of State has their share of the blame, of course. I would say that, you know this, sir, that it's a small department compared to the Department of Defense. The Foreign Service officers don't make it up a lot. But that really
more people in military bands than we have in the Foreign Service.
Exactly. And that, yes, maybe, I don't know the ins and outs of, like, you know, maybe, you know, Ambassador Wilson should have called it earlier. But I would always go back and say, well, the reason why he's put in this position is because the military strategy failed.
Yeah.
The thing that we did for 20 years did not work. And then I would also look at, what was it, a really great idea to pull everybody out of the provinces and just make a little place in Kabul, 2,500 people more or less, with a security element. And then your evacuation point is halfway across the city in a very hard to defend airport.
Well, but pulling out of Bagram also left you with a single point of failure.
Yes.
I mean, why wouldn't you have had belt and suspenders?
Yes. No, I totally agree. I think there should have been multiple ones. And I think part of the problem over the last year was that we forget that it was COVID. And so people weren't communicating with each other. It was a lot harder to we couldn't even walk across the street from the embassy to Resolute Support. It was all VTCs. I don't think people really, it sunk in that we were leaving. And I just don't think there was a sense of urgency behind it. I just think that didn't really think that it would fall that quickly, even though there was a lot of signs in it. And you could see that in the way that we even left Bagram, like you alluded to, kind of just overnight. And then also like Kandahar airfield. And we tried to work with the Afghans into that. But even by the time we pulled out of that, they weren't really ready yet. And it is because we built these airports and we built all this stuff and it was an enormous and it was hard for them to protect. So I just don't think that there was, I think everybody that has something to do with it is to blame, because we're all a part of this whole thing that happened in Afghanistan. But I think that General Milley and General McKenzie, I think that there's a lot of stuff that the military got wrong. And I think it would be really beneficial for a lot of Afghan combat veterans, for senior leaders, retired senior leaders, to come out and own this and say that we lost, and that unlike in Vietnam, we're going to actually learn from our mistakes here and we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again, because there hasn't been any of that accountability yet. And it's hurting.
Very much introspection.
Yes. Yeah. And it's hurting, and it's hurting our recruiting. It plays a part in that whole thing as well.
I want to turn to the recruiting issues in a moment, Will, because in another hat that I wear on the National Defense Strategy Commission, we're wrestling with this whole question, since all of the services save the Marines are missing their recruiting calls, although some are doing a little bit better now and more recently, but it's still a big problem for the Army, Air Force, and Navy. But before we get there, I want to, you know, sort of tie this other element up about the withdrawal. You were saying that there hasn't been enough introspection, you know, on the part of the military, and I agree with that. There was, you know, this whole episode with the so-called Afghanistan papers that appeared in the Washington Post that some people have compared to the Pentagon papers. I'd be curious to your reaction to that. My reaction was that the Post kind of mischaracterized a lot of what was in those documents. I mean, many of those documents were interviews with people for various efforts by the military to derive lessons learned. And so they were encouraging people to speak candidly. And the candor about our deficiencies and mistakes that were made, you know, then somehow got turned into people were, you know, lying to the American people. And my own sense of it is that if our military in particular has an ethos, which is a can-do ethos, it's very hard for people in the military to say, yeah, we're failing at something. And we tend also to try and apply metrics to a lot of what we're doing, which frequently is things like morale and, you know, military capability of units. These things are not kind of strictly speaking measurable by, you know, quantitative metrics, but we want to put a metric on it. And so, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld used to say, you get what you measure, you know, and so I think a lot of people with the best of intentions were, deluding themselves, maybe deluding their superiors, but not out of malevolence or, you know, a desire to lie to people, but because they were trying to accomplish what they were being asked to do in the only way they knew how and couldn't square it up. But I'm curious whether, you know, what your take is on
it. No, I totally agree with your take. I think that when I say accountability, I don't think, I'm sure there's instances, but the vast majority of people were there that were just trying to accomplish the mission and win the war. We just kind of figure out what that meant. I think what at the start of it, the Washington Post revelations, I'll be honest with you, I found it, that whole expose to be kind of, telling that this was some type of, you know, big admission that the war wasn't going well, when you could read anywhere anything about it that would probably say the same thing. These were just people that were trying to do it, lessons learned, and that they were just talking about some of the deficiencies that they had seen in the system. And I want to encourage people to be able to do that, not discourage them by then leaking it and saying that they were lying and then with the government's lying to the people. I think that was a little bit too hyperbolic. And I think that the strategy in Afghanistan, the military one, it failed for lots of different reasons. And it's not that people went in there with malevolent intent. It failed, a lot of different structural reasons, and people don't understanding the Afghans, not understanding the Taliban, not understanding the region, putting the personnel policy, all that type of stuff. But they didn't go in there to lie to people. I don't believe that at all.
Right. And what gets lost, and you've adverted to this in your comments, what gets lost is all the progress that genuinely was made. And the education of a whole generation of Afghans, particularly women. I mean, there was a lot that was lost. And again, I mean, one reason why I disagree with the decision that was made was those gains, which were very real, were purchased, you know, in blood and treasure. And to some degree, the decision to leave and the way that we left kind of threw all that away. And I think I can't think of anything that in some ways dishonors, you know, the memory of those who gave their lives in Afghanistan more than that.
Yeah. I think that the biggest victims of the Afghan war are the Afghans themselves. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends, and a lot of them are Americans, but also Afghans as well. And they were left behind. You can agree with the decision to withdraw. You can agree with the decision, I don't really care. That's a different conversation. You know, we've been having a little bit of that. But I think at the fundamental thing that people need to realize is that we left behind our allies, and not just combat interpreters, although they get a lot of the love. Afghan Special Operation Forces, there was 3,200 female inside the ANDSF. And towards the end, we were trying to push the Afghan government to bring in more. And all of them were left behind. And now you have a gender apartheid regime who is flogging and stoning and killing people and hunting our Afghan allies. Everybody in the world can see that this happened. And it is a very, very, very big, ugly stain on the United States. And the American combat veterans see it. They know that. And it's a shame that it's, maybe it's understood, but I don't think it's, people really, really understand what happened when we pulled out. And to the Afghans that were there that believed in us, they're the ones that are now trapped and they're being hunted.
Yeah, I mean, this all gets lost in the blather about, you know, ending, you know, forever wars and all that nonsense. Let's turn to the recruiting piece of this, Will. You raised it. We are facing a problem of recruitment. What do you see as the major elements of the recruiting crisis, and how much should Americans be concerned about the survival of the all-volunteer force and our ability to man, train, and equip it?
I think it should be very worried about it. I don't think it's getting nearly enough press. It's a national security crisis. It's just that, again, all volunteer force, most Americans aren't affected by it. So they don't have skin in the game, which is one of the problems with the all volunteer force. But I think when you get to it is that to understand the military is that 80% of military members come from military families. Somebody in the immediate family or just one removed served in the military. So you get 80% of your force from there. So when you have only 63% of active duty military members saying that they would recommend military service, which is a 12-point drop since 2019, that's a huge problem. But even bigger is that a recent survey by the Blue Star Families found that only 32% of family members would recommend military service. That is a 20-point drop in 7 years. That is enormous. And because there's only a small segment of the population that qualifies for military service for physical standards and drug use and all that type of stuff. So you already have a small pool to pick with just off of that. And now you're starting to see quality of life issues, which is the big thing for military families, like spousal employment and stuff like that. And, you know, the economy, having a good economy always hurts recruiting. So those are all quality of life issues is a big, big, big deal. It's a big reason. But I would also say that for especially the active duty service members and veterans, Afghanistan is a huge deal. It is just, the war might be over for Americans, but it's not over for most combat veterans. It has left a huge, huge wave of moral injury that is ripping across the Afghan combat veteran community. And they talk, and I know tons of my friends are like, why would I recommend service to anybody after what happened? After what the government did to me, no way. And I think to combat that is going to be a really big effort to try to get the recruiting numbers up because we need more recruits. We are facing, you know, near peer adversaries, and it's going to require more and more. The military is just as busy now as they were during the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. They're just spread all over the globe now.
Yeah, and I mean the challenges we face are enormous. With, as you say, two near peer competitors. I mean, we don't have quite the rotational deployment issues, you know, that we had when we had a lot of folks forward in CENTCOM. Although we still have, you know, I haven't checked the numbers recently, but I know last time I checked it was around 35,000, 40,000 and it's probably up a bit since October 7th, obviously, because of deployments. But still, you know, we may end up needing, and we've let the Army, you know, get quite small, and the Air Force, I think, is the smallest it's been maybe since Korea. And same with the Navy. So I agree with you. You know, it's a it is a huge national security crisis. Let me ask you, in does it raise questions for you about the you know, survivability of the all volunteer force? Do we need to go to a different model? Do we need to go back to a draft? Should we have national service of some kind? The thing that worries me, I mean, I'm part of the Vietnam generation. And so I, you know, I had a draft card, I had a number in the lottery, and you know, I watched the draft go away while I was in college. The thing I worry about is, you know, our military proficiency has largely been built on the back of a professional all-volunteer force. And particularly as warfare becomes more technology focused, with new technologies, you know, sort of bringing us to the cusp of another military technical revolution with autonomy and AI and biotech and nanotechnology. I mean, all these things are playing, you know, are playing or going to play a role in the future. You know, not to mention already we've got, you know, cyberspace, you know, quantum computing and et cetera. I mean, you need a highly skilled, highly trained force. So I worry about the idea of going back to a draft, but what is your sense?
Yeah, I'm not in favor of going back to a draft. I mean, I don't think it would ever be politically feasible, and even theoretically, I don't. I just the concerns that you raise are my. I have the same concerns. I think there's a lot of problems, and one of them is that the Americans don't understand the military, and the military doesn't understand Americans. And I think that, you know, if you look at it, the vast majority of teenagers can't name like all the five branches, right? Like 20%. I think there is a lack of civics inside of primary schools. And just teaching high schoolers about the military would be invaluable to, you know, this is, you know, the United States military. Just because you join the military doesn't mean they're going to give you a gun and like send you to the front lines, right? If you're worried about that. There's a lot of different skill sets that you can get in the military. You know, I criticize the military, but I love the military. I think it's an incredible institution that has so many amazing people from all walks of life. If you want to get, you know, encouraged and face and get some optimism, go meet a first generation American who just becomes a military member. It's amazing. I have former interpreters who came to the United States, became SIVs, became American citizens, and went and joined. So it's a great institution. But I think that, you know, we have to teach Americans about it, and then also connect active duty and veterans back to the population that they serve. You know, since 9/11, you know, it's hard for people to get inside the military bases because of counterterrorism threats. I would be in favor of lowering that threshold. I think it's good for us to all be together and to have a little bit less of the deification of the military. I think that we went from, you know, Vietnam, where it was, you know, protesting the soldiers, and then we swung all the way because we didn't want to do that, into a little bit too much idol worship. And it needs to be a little bit, you know, not in the middle, but more to the right a little bit, where people can understand the military. Because at the end of the day, the military needs Americans to obviously serve, but also it needs Americans to hold us accountable for when we don't do things right. And if you don't know the military and you don't understand it, then you won't be able to hold it accountable. And I think that's really necessary. And I think it's necessary for, you know, high schoolers to understand it before they serve. The last year in active duty that I was in, we had a JROTC, a detachment that would come to our base It was inner city, with a really low graduation rate inside this high school. If you went and did the JROTC program in this high school for all 4 years, 99% graduation rate. So there's a lot of goodness that comes out of this. And JROTC is one of those programs that can be really, really powerful to try to get our recruitment up.
We talked about a lot of these issues actually with Peter Fever.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I heard the episode.
In that episode of Shield of the Republic a couple of months back, when Peter, of course, working on a lot of the issues that you're mm-hmm. talking about, Will. Will, we've run out of time, but I really want to thank you for, you know, coming on Shield of the Republic and sharing your experiences. And I want to make sure our listeners know that not only can they read you in the pages of the Bulwark, but they can read you on your Substack, Grumpy Combat Veteran, and soon be able to hear you in Shoulder to Shoulder, your forthcoming podcast that you're co-hosting. So look forward to that. And thanks very much for joining us on Shield of the Republic.
It was an honor. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.